1958, a then young and aspiring poet published a collection of his writings, a little booklet called A Coney Island of the Mind. One of those poems was titled Christ Climbed Down. I'm going to read a portion of it. Christ climbed down from his bare tree this year and ran away to where there were no rootless Christmas trees hung with candy canes and breakable stars. Christ climbed down from his bare tree this year and ran away to where there were no gilded Christmas trees and no tinsel Christmas trees and no tinfoil Christmas trees and no pink plastic Christmas trees and no black Christmas trees and no powder blue Christmas trees hung with electric candles and encircled by 10 electric trains and clever cornball relatives. Christ climbed down from his bare tree this year and ran away to where no intrepid Bible salesman covered the territory in two-tone Cadillacs, and where no Sears Roebuck Precious, complete with the plastic babe and manger, arrived by parcel post, the babe by special delivery. Christ climbed down from his bare tree this year and softly stole away into some anonymous Mary's womb again, where in the darkest night of everybody's anonymous soul, he awakes again. An unimaginable and impossibly immaculate reconception, the very craziest of second comings. The first time I ever heard this poem, it was delivered with a British accent. I was in my sophomore year of college, and an honest-to-God English professor was spending the year on campus in some kind of professorial exchange arrangement. Shortly before the Christmas break, he visited an English class I was taking, and in the course of his conversation with us, said he had a Christmas poem by Mr. Ferlin Getty that he wanted to read to us. The name meant nothing to me at the time. He read Christ Climbed Down in its entirety. What you heard was a slightly abridged version. As he read, I could feel my breathing quicken a bit. And I went into frown mode. I couldn't quite pin it down, but I was sure I was hearing something terribly sacrilegious. I was still firmly ensconced at that time in my evangelical Baptist upbringing, and anything that gave off even the slightest hint of making light of or demeaning Jesus Christ was just simply not a good thing. It sounded like Jesus was being trifled with and that the celebration of his birth was being ridiculed. And even though I knew a lot of the trappings of the Christmas season, that this Mr. Ferlin Getty, whoever he was having a little fun with, really had nothing to do with the birth of Jesus anyway, I still felt like my religion was being put down by some stuffy British academic reading a poem by some guy from California. Then he got to the last lines. Christ climbed down from his bare tree this year and softly stole away into some anonymous Mary's womb again, where in the darkest night of everybody's anonymous soul, he awaits again an unimaginable and impossibly immaculate reconception, the very craziest of second comings. I didn't quite hear, much less fully grasp, all that was being said in that last verse at that moment. But the idea that the second coming, the very craziest of second comings, as this line goes, is really a rebirth of all that Jesus represented within everyone's anonymous soul, switched on a light bulb for me. This wasn't quite the same Jesus as the supernatural Savior whom God had dispatched to suffer and die for my sins, and that was something I doggone well better believe in if I wanted to save myself from the punishments of hell. The notion that everyone's anonymous soul was the true locale of this craziest second comings caught me off guard. It made a crazy kind of sense in a way that actually frightened me. Frightened me because it posed a challenge to my religious worldview at that time. A view that I was doggedly determined to hold on to in the face of all this liberal thought I was being exposed to, even at a state university in southern West Virginia. Well, it would be far from correct to say that my whole 19-year, I was 19 years old when all this happened, and it would be far from correct to say that my whole 19-year-old religious worldview came tumbling down in that moment, because it didn't. I didn't walk out of the classroom as a suddenly reborn religious liberal. That process took a few more years. But hearing this poem, especially that last verse, that comes after Ferlinghetti has had a little fun getting in his jabs at some of our seasonal silliness circa the early 1950s, that provided one of the first cracks in my near fundamentalist consciousness as to what the true nature of not just Christianity, but religion itself might and could be. In more recent years, I've had the opportunity on a couple of occasions to meet the author of this and scores of other poems he's written. I don't know how many of you may have had the experience of coming face to face with someone who had a hand in rearranging your brains, but I thought rather mind-blowing. I actually had to thank the man for making a mess of my life sometime back when. I'll do a little more with this poem in a few minutes, but first I'd like to take you on a brief side excursion into the life of its author, and I know I've told some parts of this story before, so if you've heard them before, I'm going to ask your forbearance for the next couple of minutes. Lawrence Ferlinghetti, by all the indications I can gather, grew up a pretty straight, arrow, nice Italian Catholic boy from Yonkers, New York in the 1920s and 30s. He was a very accomplished student. He was an Eagle Scout. He reported for active duty when the Second World War broke out. And by the time D-Day arrived, he was a lieutenant commander in the Navy and commanded a submarine chaser as part of that momentous Normandy invasion on that day. About a year and a half later, he'd been relocated to Nagasaki, Japan, in the aftermath of the dropping of the atomic bomb on that city. And that was an experience that proved to rearrange his brains. The rationale for dropping the bomb notwithstanding, his awareness of the human capacity to inflict mass death on other human beings made an indelible impression upon the young Lieutenant Commander Lawrence Ferlinghetti. It was just 3 years ago that he looked back on that experience in an interview he gave to the San Francisco Chronicle, and he said, "Before Nagasaki, I was a good American boy. I was the commander of a sub-chaser in the Normandy invasion. Anyone who saw Nagasaki would suddenly realize that they had been kept in the dark by the United States as to what atomic bombs can do." I believe it was witnessing death on such a massive scale, which also demonstrated the utter fragility of life. That was one of the things that challenged many of those who were of an artistic or poetic or literary bent, the advocates for life in the face of the possibility of the widespread human, or the potential, widespread human potential for destroying life. After the war, life looked very cheap. How then do we stand for its essential holiness was part of the question being asked. This was part of the impetus that gave rise to what came to be called the Beat Generation writers. So wherever Ferlinghetti's life may have been headed, it took a turn after his World War II experience. The war ended. He studied for a time at the Sorbonne in Paris, where he earned a doctorate. And then he settled into San Francisco, where in 1952, he and a partner opened up a bookstore and a small press outfit, giving it the Charlie Chaplin-esque name of City Lights, and that operates to this very day. His store and his press became one of the primary outlets for the literature of the Beat Movement. The man who was one of the midwives as it were of this movement, and who now at age 85 has become its elder statesman, is still going strong as a poet, painter, essayist, and business person. And I've come a long way since I was first introduced to him by way of his poem, Christ Climbed Down, at the age of 19. Mr. Ferlinghetti has come to disavow Christianity and the Christian faith as a matter of faith and doctrine. But as this and others of his poems indicate, he seemed to remain fascinated with the person of Jesus and his continuing presence in our world. And the same goes for me on both counts. And it is Ferlinghetti's poem, From One Non-Christian to Another, as it were, that helps to provide me with a reason to continue to honor and celebrate the birth of Jesus. I mentioned earlier that my hearing of Christ climbed down for the first time had the effect of kind of rearranging my thought processes, rearranging my brain. At that time, however, I had neither a language I could speak nor a framework of understanding in my mind that allowed me to get a good handle on what all this brain rearranging was about. That came later. It came when I realized that stories and myths and legends are not about events that happened out there somewhere in time and in geographical space, but about events that are taking place within us instead. Yes, I believe someone named Jesus of Nazareth did live and carry forth the ministry that is approximated in the New Testament Gospels. But those Gospels are shrouded in myth and legend. And myths and legends are about things that happen, as Mr. Ferlinghetti put it, in everybody's anonymous soul. I don't know that it was immaculate or not, but when I grasped that, it was a significant and very meaningful reconception for me. If there are going to be any second comings, of the craziest kind or not, they will come, and only come, in the lives we choose to lead, the values we seek to embody or incarnate, and the willingness on our parts to be bearers of life and life abundant, in the face of the many kinds of deaths that diminish, demean, belittle, or destroy life. For the Christian, the message in this story, or legend, or myth, is that God decided to give humanity another chance by appearing on earth as a human being. First in the form of a helpless child, and later, child grew up as an adult human being who tried to bring those with whom he came into contact into a full realization of their own humanity while also teaching the ways of love and compassion and justice. That the life and teachings of this wise and humble man and the religion that came to be generated in his name have become, in the hands of some, and only some, I should emphasize, but had become in the hands of some an instrument or means of perpetuating bigotry and fear and division is something that infuriates me above all else. But that's a subject for another sermon. I want to stay on the goodwill side of the street this morning. I respect and I honor the Christian interpretation of this legend. In fairness, I should say interpretations, for there are many ways of understanding it, even within the Christian communion. As a religious humanist, the message I take from this story is that life keeps giving us another chance and another challenge with each new life that comes into the world. Each new life that comes into the world from some anonymous Mary's womb again. How we respond to that challenge is, as I noted, in our hearts and in our hands. We have each been given a life. A life which we can use to say yes to those things that nurture and enhance the lives of others and the life of our earth, and to say no principalities and powers that would diminish and destroy life. And we can use this life that we've been given to be a witness for peace, even in the face of all that threatens or denies us peace. And within this community here, we can use the lives we've been given to attend to and celebrate the many joys that are in our midst. And we can use the lives we've been given to reach out to those who are experiencing, particularly this time of year, times of pain and loss and despair that are inevitably visited upon all of us at some point in our lives. So in the story of the birth of Jesus, I see a paradigm for each new life that comes into the world, and a reminder that each such new life is also about my life and about our lives and the human responsibility to which each new life calls us. One of my predecessors in this pulpit from the late 1940s, Reverend Ernest Sommerfeld, penned some words, and I don't know quite what was in his mind when he wrote them, but it sounds like he meant them as part of an imaginary dialogue he was having with a more traditional colleague or friend about the Christmas celebration. Here's the reading. Why do you celebrate Christmas? You do not believe in virgin births. You do not believe Jesus was a deity. You probably don't believe in angels. True. But we believe in songs, which are born in the hearts and minds of people. We believe that some stories deserve to live forever because of what they tell us about ourselves. The angels singing an anthem of peace and goodwill deserve to be heard forever, because they are the angels in human hearts. The humble shepherds who have ears to hear and hearts to receive a message of joy deserve to live to the end of time. The wise men, so faithfully seeking the way of the star, deserve to go in search again each year, as long as years shall be. For they are the story of our quest for ourselves. I had the chance pleasure of meeting up with one of Reverend Sommerfeld's sons up at Ferry Beach last summer when we were up there for our weekend. And he and I had a very pleasant conversation. I told him that some of his father's words are still spoken from the Nashua UU pulpit on occasion. And he told me an interesting story. He said back in the late 1940s during his father's ministry here, his father got in some hot water when on a Sunday prior to Thanksgiving, he took up a collection to benefit a worthy cause in the community. I told him we've gotten past that now. But back to the words just quoted as a way of bringing these thoughts to a conclusion. When Reverend Sommerfeld says that the Christmas story is the story of a quest for ourselves, he was not, I am sure, saying it in a narcissistic or self-indulgent way. He meant that it is a quest to know our deeper selves, our truer selves, our healed and reconciled selves, and our hopeful selves. Most important, it is the selves we have to offer and to share with one another. So my hope in this season is that the stories, modern and ancient, whether in the language of the New Testament or in the language of a now aging San Francisco poet, I hope they are all stories that will aid us and inspire us on our quest to be more human in a world that is very much in need of our humanity. In that spirit, let's sing together.